Hello, and welcome to New Books in Biblical Studies, where we look at books about the Bible, from modern-day commentaries and art books to scholarly monographs and reference works. I'm Garrett Brown, the host of the channel. On today's program, I'm talking with Scott McKendrick and Kathleen Doyle about their new book, The Art of the Bible, Illuminated Manuscripts from the Medieval World, published by Thames and Hudson in November 2016. The book looks at 45 featured manuscripts from across the globe and through 1,000 years of history, with such names as the Lindisfarne Gospels, the Queen Mary Psalter, the Canterbury Royal Bible, the Old English Hexateuch, the Wells Apocalypse, and the Padawan Bible Picture Book. With more than 300 illustrations, which have been meticulously color-corrected for this new publication, the authors shed light on some of the finest but least known paintings from the Middle Ages, and on the development of art, literature, and civilization as we know it. Dr. Scott McKendrick is the head of Western Heritage Collections at the British Library. His publications include Codex Sinaiticus, New Perspective on the Ancient Biblical Manuscript, Illuminating the Renaissance, the Triumph of Flemish Manuscript Painting in Europe, and The Bible as Book, Transmissions of the Greek Text. Dr. Kathleen Doyle is the lead curator of Illuminated Manuscripts at the British Library. She was the co-creator, with Dr. McKendrick, of an Arts and Humanities Research Council-funded exhibition, Royal Manuscripts, The Genius of Illumination, and the lead investigator for the Royal Manuscripts follow-on project, editing with Dr. McKendrick the volume 1,000 Years of Royal Books and Manuscripts. Together, they also edited Bible Manuscripts, 1,400 Years of Scribes and Scripture, published by the British Library in 2007. Without further ado, I hope you enjoyed today's program. All right. Well, Scott McKendrick and Kathleen Doyle, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Well, right off the bat, I want to say what an absolutely gorgeous book you've created with your publisher, Thames and Hudson.
It's absolutely breathtaking.
It's an oversized volume that is a little over 10 inches by 12 and a half inches in trim, and almost an inch and a half thick. And the paper, the cover is a paper overboard with a gold foil stamping for the title and a cloth spine. And the paper is a rich matte stock. And it really is, since we're talking about the material production of manuscripts, it's so fitting that Thames and Hudson has done such a excellent job of packaging this book and, as befits the content.
Well, that's very much what we aim to do. That was part of the concept of the book from the outset.
And so you played a role in its design from the beginning?
We were very involved, and we had a fantastic designer, but we spent literally days with him and with our publisher in front of his computer screen, adjusting every single image. And as you will have seen, it's very much an image-led book with at least 4 full-page images for each Bible entry, and many have more. And we worked with him to crop them and make them look as in some ways better than they do in the flesh. So we're really, really pleased with what he was able to achieve.
Yes, I think what's distinctive about the book is the full bleed images, where the images, they run off the edges of the page, allowing you to get very up close to the images and to see the detail in a way that maybe you wouldn't even be able to see when you're looking at the original, because you're highlighting something in particular.
Well, bear in mind that many of these manuscripts are things that people are very unlikely to ever see, or maybe see once in their life. They tend to be exhibited rarely and seen by specialists. So this was a chance for people to really see into those books. We do have online presentations, which helps. But what we also wanted to do in the book was to ensure that what people saw was faithful to the originals. So the other thing that we did, as well as work closely on the design, was actually work very closely together on the color quality. And several of the things, for those who have seen them in reproduction before, may be a bit of a surprise, but actually we've corrected them 2-3 times against the original, and they're as close as they possibly could be.
Oh, that's interesting. Because in the reproduction process, when it was photographed, and in the way that the book is printed itself, there can be distortion in the color.
Indeed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There are many of the things that are reproduced here, which have they look very different in in other books, shall we say?
Yeah.
And as you'll know, it's a real challenge because, of course, we're covering a huge range, both geographically and in terms of chronology, of over 1,000 years. And the way that parchment is produced varies enormously. So when in the book things are not, the parchment isn't the same color, it's because they're not in real life the same color. And I'm really pleased that we have been able to be so faithful to how they really look.
Mm-hmm. So how many years has this been in the making?
Oh, golly. Four?
Yeah, 3 or 4, I think. Depends when the clock starts ticking.
A lot of weekends.
A lot of weekends.
A lot of weekends.
Mm-hmm. Yes, excellent. Well, why don't we back up and tell us a little bit about your background and how you started working on illuminated manuscripts and what brought you to this project in particular.
Okay. Scott is indicating that I should start. I have kind of an unusual path to manuscripts, I guess. I started out as a corporate lawyer working on aircraft finance transactions, and about 15 years ago thought that I wanted to do something that I was much more passionate about. So I went to the Courtauld Institute and got a doctorate in art history, and then I've been at the library here for about 12 years working as a curator of illuminated manuscripts. So it's a great privilege to work with such an enormous, impressive collection, and what we wanted to do with this book was really to show the incredible breadth of the riches here and to make them available as widely as possible.
So it's difficult to follow that. my pathway was somewhat more conventional. I read classics at Oxford, and during that course I became more and more interested in art history, so then went to the Courtauld a little bit earlier, and then towards the end of my research there, I joined the library, and that was in 1986. So I've been here for 30 years, working at the British Library, and like Kathleen, really appreciate the fact that it is a great privilege to work with such fantastic collections and actually fantastic colleagues as well. This book is but one symptom of the collections, which are enormous, wide-ranging, and there are very few other collections that you could do such a book just based on. It's pretty remarkable, actually.
Right. The British Library itself has a huge manuscript collection, and it's not just limited to Bible manuscripts, but Bible manuscripts actually do constitute one of the large, compared to other places, the British Library has a large number of manuscripts. And so that's out of which that's where this collection is drawn. Is that right?
Yes. So the British Library has arguably the most, I suppose the deepest and widest collection of manuscripts in the world, in any research library. It probably doesn't have the largest collection of Bibles. You'll not be surprised that that's probably the Vatican Library. But I think in terms of the sort of geographic span and the chronological range of its materials, it is pretty preeminent across, not just Bibles, but across the entirety of its manuscript collections.
And that's one thing we very much wanted to reflect in the book. You will see an incredible range, and that's thanks in part to Scott's language skills, which he's mentioned. So we're able to include books from all over Europe and really stretching the boundaries of what would be considered medieval in a traditional sense by starting with something from the 6th century and then going up really into the early modern period in areas where manuscript production continues.
How would you say, in your experience, how much carryover and experience and sort of training is there between these medieval manuscripts, their particular biblical texts, and other non-biblical texts? Like, how did you, does an art history background really help to inform, because a lot of it is this material production, or do you start with, looking at it from a more focused on the religious or the, cultural significance? You know, how is it that they those two things inform each other?
We wanted to do both, mm-hmm. but it's entitled The Art of the Bible. And so one of the one thing that these books have in common is that they had to be very lavishly illustrated. Now, that's not all figurative imagery, but they are decorated, and they are books of the Christian Bible. So in this book, we're not including Bibles from other traditions. So that being said, we wanted very much to show the range of how this most fundamental text could be illustrated, and indeed to explore the relationship between text and image. So, for example, we've included several illustrated copies of the Book of Revelation, usually called Apocalypse, mm-hmm. which are typically dominated. The top half of the page is an image, and the bottom half of the page will include the biblical text, but summarized, and together with a commentary telling you what it is. And some of those are in Latin, and some of those are in a vernacular language of Anglo-Norman French. So what we wanted to do was with both, really. We wanted to explore the importance of the biblical text give a sense of some of the varieties of the ways in which it was illustrated.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, could I just sort of add to that, that one of the key points here during this the entire manuscript period is that complete Bibles mm-hmm. are much rarer than in the printed era. So once you get to printing, obviously you start with Gutenberg's Bible, and thereafter it tends to be the default position that you include the whole Old Testament and the New Testament. In the manuscript era, when you've got to painstakingly write something by hand, you focus on what's most important. And so you copy the Gospels, you copy the Psalms, and then you copy anything else that's really, really critical for the need at the time, which might be to do with the liturgy, it could be to do with the services, it could be to do with education or instruction or whatever it is. But you only do what's necessary.
And how much is there an overlap between texts that are textually important versus ones that are artistically important? I mean, there are a number of Bibles where it's the received text, and that is what has gone into the tradition of determining, between all the different variants and different manuscripts. Are there clear lines of or genealogies of these manuscripts, and do they overlap the ones that we count on for the Textus Receptus, you know, versus the ones that are illuminated, or do the illuminated ones sort of have their own direction and development, lines of development?
Maybe I'll give a couple of examples first, and Scott sure. will probably think of others. I think both are true, and some of these, it's because they're just so important, and the first complete manuscript in the book is the Lindisfarne Gospel, this incredibly well-known and elaborated book made in Lindisfarne around 700. About two centuries later, in the 10th century, someone came along and wrote in a complete interlinear gloss in Old English above the Latin text, which is the earliest version of the Bible of the New Testament in English. So in that case, both are true. It's an incredible work of art and incredibly important textually. There are other examples, for example, and we try to include many vernacular translations, which are either the earliest or the most important in their genres.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think the earlier manuscripts tend to be the better texts. So, you know, and in their, for example, the Carolingian Bible, mm-hmm. The Moutier-Grandval Bible is part of a group of manuscripts that attempt to refresh the translation of St. Jerome, or initiated by St. Jerome, the Bible translated into Latin, and it's another attempt to refine that, mm-hmm. to cleanse it. So it's an important part of that story, but obviously the later you go on, frankly, the less important the texts are, and mm-hmm. the more important everything else is, and the sort of mm-hmm. broader right. cultural yeah. context that they represent.
The translations can be very important, though, for example. So we have the a Bulgarian Bible, which I think is that the... A very early translation.
One of the earliest, yeah.
Another example would be, as you know, St. Jerome translated the Psalms a number of occasions. So we have all the versions of his three principal translations, and at least one case in the monastic study Bibles, we have an example where all three versions are displayed together, side by side. So there are some... I think, well, I don't know if anyone would want the book if they weren't interested in art, but if you were, there's still a lot that's very important just with the text in these books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, picking up on the point about translation towards the end of the book, then you really start to get the, I suppose, what's leading towards a sort of reformed view of the Bible. It's still not challenging the authority of the Latin text, which has the authority of the Church, but it is seeking to make the text more accessible to more people, essentially. So that, in a sense, leads to the sort of Tyndale idea that you know, that it should speak to the plowboy.
Right. I just wanted to clarify that point for listeners, because I think it is a question that they have, is what does this represent, you know, a development in the, you know, in the tradition of the text? And so it's something that they might have in mind, and how it leads to some questions about what unfolds after Gutenberg. And we'll come back to that.
Right.
I wondered if we might sort of contextualize this, you know, where does the book begin and end, and are there historical or cultural moments that allow the illumination or illustration of the Bible to, you know, come to the fore? You know, maybe there are material causes or cultural changes that put an emphasis on it, and then why does it why does it drop off? Is it the printing press, or are, you know, to, maybe it drops off before then? So I wondered if we might just kind of talk about beginnings and endings a bit.
Shall I do that? Yeah, so let's start at the beginning, as it were. So the book kicks off in terms of its examples with a rather amazing example from the late 6th, early 7th century. Just to give some context, we're in Constantinople, the then capital of the Christian world, without question, probably the sort of New York of its time in many ways, as a sort of imperial capital. Here we are in not quite the beginnings of early Christian art, but pretty close to it. So illumination in Christian books comes in really in the 5th century. Mm-hmm. So we're just a little bit later than that.
And
in history terms, we're in a British context, we're probably around the time that Gregory sends Augustine to, mm-hmm. yeah. to England, you know, just at that turn of the two centuries. Mm-hmm. We are in a broader historical perspective. We are somewhere between Justinian and Heraclius, the Eastern emperors, just before the Islamic developments in the Middle East and the impact that has on the mm-hmm. Byzantine Empire. So it's quite a moment in many ways.
So at the beginning, is there a shift in a kind of reluctance to have more representational art in a Bible out of fear that it might be considered idolatry or somehow irreverent to include images in a sacred text?
Well,
is that not really operative?
It's not operative at this moment.
Uh-huh.
So we've already in the 5th century seen very lavishly illustrated manuscripts, the most famous of which is in the British Library's collections is the so-called Cotton Genesis,
yes.
which is a copy of the Book of Genesis, which is more illustrated than any other subsequent copy of that text. So there wasn't a problem with figural narrative illustration from that date. What will happen is a bit later than our manuscript, and perhaps Kathleen wants to talk about that, because there's a difference between West and East at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I should just mention that we have an introduction before we start the 45 examples of the Bible, where we illustrate these texts, these manuscripts that we're talking about, and we have a fairly extensive discussion of these questions. What's the function of illumination? Practical questions of what's it made? And this whole question of the interpretation of the Second Commandment, as you've pointed out. And we quote in there the resolution of this issue in the 8th century in the East, which is sort of distinguishing between using images to honor and to show what should be given veneration and the veneration of the images themselves, that crucial distinction about which discussion carries on today. So that's reflected in the text, and indeed in one of these fantastic Greek psalters, which is called a marginal psalter, which is has very extensive decoration in the margins, as you would expect, commenting on the text pictorially. There are images of this so-called iconoclastic conflict and the various figures who played a part in that.
And then before we look at some specific examples in your book, Where does the book end? And is there a transition from a medieval manuscript illumination into something else, or does the tradition continue?
Okay, so the three last items.
Mm-hmm.
The first of those ends. It was made in 1478, so after the introduction of printing with movable type. So made at Rome, a place where there's a vibrant printing activity going on already. And it is really, it's very much the last throw of the dice in the Western world. Interestingly, it's actually a copy of the Greek Gospels being produced in Rome after the fall of Constantinople, and somehow responding to this resurgence of interest in broader Greek culture.
Mm.
So that's where we are. But in further to the east, in different Christian contexts, manuscript culture continues and is very vibrant and is very much part of the mainstream because they don't have printing. So the penultimate item is a copy of the Gospels in Armenian, actually produced in Iran or modern-day Iran, at Isfahan. In a context where wealthy Armenian merchants and community, in order to get copies of their sacred text, have to have manuscript versions. And in order to have a copy that is worthy of the scriptures, they want to be suitably grand, which it is. And then we end up even further away from the West, in Ethiopia in the late 17th century. The Armenian one was in earlier in the 17th century, at the imperial capital Gondar. Again, no possibility of having a printed version, but actually the artists are emulating something earlier. Mm. But they're very much still part of the vibrant, creative tradition of illumination. It's not just some eccentricity. This is still a vibrant culture.
Mm. So at that point, how does the tradition extend down to Ethiopia? How does it, how is that that tradition and the practice transmitted through cultures? Is there evidence of direct influence, or are they aware of other examples? How does that work when you know, obviously travel is much more limited, and you know, the technology doesn't allow for multiple copies?
Sure. Well, the Ethiopian book is a very interesting example where you do have essentially a well-established indigenous tradition, but by this date you're also getting references to probably transmitted through engravings or through printed items, Western printed items. So you are starting to get quite a meld of imagery, where some of the imagery looks very purely Ethiopic,
mm-hmm.
and then others are actually looking very Western. And so you have quite an interest. It's very interesting, but the tradition holds up. It doesn't start to look disparate. It's actually absorbing that and reinterpreting it in a very interesting way.
I'm actually turning the pages of the book. I know you don't have it in front of you to see it, but when Scott uses the term vibrant, it is exactly right. There's these brilliant oranges, reds, greens. Again, if you look at it, you think, well, that can't possibly be right, but it is. So this incredibly, I think, to modernize, a very sort of powerful image, but yet iconographically, in terms of its subject, it is recognizable. We've reproduced, for example, an image of the Nativity, the Crucifixion, which is the same sort of scenes that are illustrated really throughout the book and throughout the Christian period, ending with an image of Christ in majesty held by the symbols of the four evangelists, which symbols start out in some of the various early examples in the book of 800 years earlier.
They're really wonderful. The four are all full bleed images right in succession, and it's a wonderful way to close the book.
Yeah, well, we really wanted to end the book on a bang rather than a whimper. We wanted something that was really not just visually strong, but represented a tradition of illumination that was still at full tilt.
Yes, the continuation of the tradition, and just so we've got Christ and Majesty at the end of the world, but probably it hasn't escaped you as well that on the front cover we have John writing. And you can see him writing in Latinus book in Principio in the beginning. And then on the back cover, we have this fabulous, one of my favorite images of an angel locking the door of the open, to the open maw of hell with everybody in this mouth, including kings and lots of demons and all kinds of unfortunate. So we really did sort of think about these design details of going from the beginning to the end.
Yes, that is a very fearsome image on the back cover.
It is, I know. You don't want to end up there.
Yes.
Which I guess is the point, really. And you know, going back to your question about the function of these images and how they enhance and interpret the biblical text, they're very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the middle of this gaping mouth there are at least 20 different characters all crammed together, looking extremely uncomfortable and suffering and pain, and it's something you definitely will linger on. Since we're starting to talk about some of the individual examples, I wonder if we can maybe cite some examples to talk about, you know, how these are made, and, you know, are some of them a single artist? Are we able to say that, or are they actually made collaboratively, like, or in schools? And in general, how can we talk about that, and maybe even thinking of some examples in specific?
Why don't I start? And again, we have a description in the introduction of all different ways in which people can collaborate, and the more technical discussion of what materials are used. Maybe I could say a little bit about the different types of illustration that are included in the book.
Oh, perfect.
So, for example, I turn to the Tiberius Psalter, which was made in Winchester in the 11th century, and it is the most extraordinary line drawing. So it's colored line drawings here. It's not painted. I suppose we would call it a wash with an ink drawing. There's some gold in halos and shields and whatnot. And we zoomed right in, for example, on the image of a rather small and youthful David killing a Goliath who fills the page. But the details of the face and the the faces and the clothing are absolutely exquisite. So here, a totally different technique from what is a similar image in other contexts. And I think that's one of the interesting things about flipping through this book is just the enormous variety in technique that is seen over the period. And maybe Scott wants to say something about individual artists in the later period. And as you know, sometimes we often don't have signatures, we don't know names, but there are a number of the most famous manuscripts which are named after the books included here. So, for example, the Queen Mary Master, who worked on probably one of the most extensively illuminated books ever made, which is called the Queen Mary Psalter.
Do you want to talk about the different techniques there? Because you've actually got the two in the one book.
Yeah. This is a good example that it has has a continuous series of images that run along the bottom of each page, from saints' lives and fighting beasts, and I've got a hunting scene shown here. And that's in a similar kind of line drawings and color wash. And then directly above it is a much more formal, more sort of visionary view of painted scenes on a burnished gold background. So very powerful and evocative interpretation of the psalm.
So shall I talk a little bit about single artists, and multiple hands, as it were?
Yeah, I think it's because we come at it, you know, with this idea, it's a very romantic idea, you know, of the individual artist, but that's really not at play here.
It isn't, no. One must imagine most of these books, and I say I'm going to make an exception, most of these books as the work of several hands, and actually, a group of people who may not actually be working side by side, so it's not necessarily the model that people often think about, where they're sort of sitting in a row and passing things along. There are notable examples where we believe that you have one person, like the Lindisfarne Gospels that Kathleen spoke about earlier, where it seems as though you've got one single scribe artist at work. But most of these volumes, the pages are prepared by one person or many people. The text is written by one person or many people. And then parts of the illumination are done by different people. And that could be different people doing different parts of the illustrations, or it could be that one person does the initials and another person does the figures, or even in some of them that one person does part of the illumination. It might be the figures and the other person does parts of the background. So there are a lot of people at work on these, but often rather than in a rigorously organized framework, often within a much looser framework where people are sort of farming things out. There may be one person who's sort of coordinating it, but they're finding different people in possibly the same street or maybe more remote in some cases. You know, it could be the next town or city, really forming a sort of loosely connected team to make these books. So it's a very, very interesting and very more and more getting to understand the different models by which these books are made.
Mm-hmm. And some of them are commissioned, actually, in cases of, royalty, but others are not. They're just part of the practice of the monastic community to reproduce them and to illuminate them for that community. Is that right?
I think there's very much a change, and this is it. Becomes quite apparent as you go from the earlier period, where it is the case that most books of any kind are made in the monastery, and probably a lot of the illumination is done there too, although there's lots of discussion about traveling lay artists who come around and help. But certainly by the later period, by the period that Scott's just been talking about, and sort of as you get toward the second half of the book, this is very much, these are commercial productions. These are people who are professionals. They're written by professional scribes. They're illuminated by groups of professional artists. And absolutely, you're right. The very, very expensive ones that can be personalized literally on every page are commissioned as bespoke luxury items. And I think as we get to the period after printing, you really see that the people who still want a handmade bespoke book want them to be as grand as possible.
Mm-hmm. You used the word luxury, and I wonder how often as you're working on this, that it seems startling, the contrast between the conditions of life then and the kind of, you know, luxury item that these individuals are working on. I mean, I have in my mind, you know, the Lindisfarne Gospels, and you know, the famous Viking raids in 793, you know, that disrupted monastic life there until something like the 11th century. And I just think of the deep contrast that these don't seem like ideal conditions, you know, to be producing these things. And yet it requires such attention and care and a refinement of sensibility. And does that ever strike you, you know, in thinking about, you know, the world in which they live, that these were really standout objects in an otherwise brutal world?
I think it's important here as well, something that you touched upon at the beginning, that these are sacred texts.
Mm-hmm.
And just going to Lindisfarne, I quote a recent, Richard Gameson's recent translation of the colophon, or the inscription at the end of the book, where the person who wrote in the English translation is saying why he did it. And he says that reflecting the view that the scribe wrote this book for God and for St. Cuthbert and for generally for all the holy folk saints who are on the island, that the ornamentation, the use of gold and gems and the luxury, if you will, of these is to glorify the sacred word, and that this is sort of a physical manifestation of the word, and therefore the expenditure is entirely appropriate to adorn the sacred text.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think also that we life was hard, but somewhere like Lindisfarne was not a sort of bywater. You know, it was a very sophisticated center, and the art that is represented in the Lindisfarne Gospels reflects that. So I think the sophistication of it shouldn't surprise us. The amount of effort to make it look so amazing shouldn't also surprise us, because time, and I think there's this current debate about whether people have enough silence in their lives. There was heaps of silence, and there were probably, although there were the, you know, life was short and there were a lot of threats to life, there weren't as many distractions. And of course, the world wasn't saturated with imagery in the way
right.
that it is now. I think there are a lot of differences. But these, one of the reasons I think that many of the items in the book survived was because they were special.
Yes.
The special things have a higher chance of surviving.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, obviously, a huge amount is lost from that period. But some of the rarest things, I mean, we have an example here at the British Library, which is a very modest gospel book, almost exactly contemporary with the Lindisfarne Gospels, but it's a much greater rarity because the sort of thing that was in daily use and, I suppose, less valued didn't survive.
I wonder if we could pivot and talk a little bit about the reception of these Bibles. How were they read in their time? Who had access to them? Could anyone access them? And how did they serve as a way for individuals who may not have been able to read to engage with the biblical story? Is that a factor here, or would most people who would have access also be literate?
That is one of the reasons that we wanted to, a third way in which we wanted to show as much breadth as possible with language, and we've alluded to this a bit before. So there are a number of instances which are quite interesting that are either bilingual with Latin and a vernacular text, or entirely in the vernacular, which very much raises the question of suggestion that these were designed to be used by a layperson who would not be entirely comfortable with the Latin Bible, though, of course, Latin is going to be, certain passages are going to be very familiar from Mass and services. So we very much want to explore that and to suggest in some cases that they're probably so sophisticated that they would be interpreted or read together with your personal chaplain. And that's also suggested by the size in many cases. In addition to the silence that Scott just mentioned, you also have, you don't turn on the TV after dinner, but we do know that you gather around and are read to. So both in secular texts and possibly some of these biblical texts as well. So I think the reading could be a different activity. And there's one particular going to this point of things being interpreted for you. We've included in the Holcomb Bible picture book, which is, as it suggests, mainly pictures with sort of captions, but again, captions in the vernacular primarily, and even a little bit of English in addition to the French. And right at the beginning of it is a Dominican pictured instructing the artist how to write, because he says this book is going to be shown to important people. So there's a sense that their reading could be a more communal activity than we maybe think of it today.
Yeah. I actually wondered, in terms of the way that the art functions for the reader, is that it also serves as a kind of community of interpretation. I mean, so much of our, you know, literary criticism now, biblical or textual criticism, you know, focuses on, you know, the written, a written interpretation of the Gospels or the biblical story. And what's just so evident here is that there is allowed not just a kind of serious play, but that the interpretation takes its form in the visual arts. And, you know, while maybe that's continued in the 21st century in film or, you know, other media, it's clear to me that it is that what you see in the art is a kind of community of interpretation that maybe we're less, that seems less obvious to us now because our Bibles are kind of stripped down and bare and they're just the text. Are there instances where you see that kind of that play or that layering of the text with other themes or images that kind of amplify something going on? Or, I mean, it's obvious that in some of the most dramatic moments, like the crucifixion and whatnot, they're very tangible and visceral, you know, representations often, just because of the dominance of the visual for us. But I wondered if you had any thoughts about that, how the visual serves as a kind of interpretive act.
So one of the most striking examples of this in the book, I think, is the so-called Theodore Psalter, made at Constantinople in 1066 at one of the most important monastic houses in Eastern Christendom, and made for the abbot. In fact, we know just about everything that you could possibly want to know about this book, who it was made for, who wrote it, etc. But it's essentially a copy of the Psalms in Greek. But although we have some imagery of David and some, if you like, narrative around David, most of the imagery is actually a Christian commentary or a contemporary or near-contemporary commentary on the text. So it uses the Psalms as a springboard to tell the audience various things. Kathleen's already alluded to the very important reference to the iconoclastic debate. Theodore, who was one of the principal figures in that debate about the value and significance of images in Christianity, was an abbot of that very same monastery. And so for the monks of this, and the abbot, his successor, it was a very, very important context. But repeatedly, icons just keep on coming up in the margins, images of the Virgin, images of Christ. Of course, this isn't illustrating the text of the Psalms. It's commenting on them. So you really have a very, very rich visual commentary in the margins of this book that is relevant in contemporary terms, but also Christianizing a Judaic text.
The other example also of the Psalms, and I think some of the most beautiful and moving paintings, is a series of, in a number of these examples, is where a whole series of full-page images, often without any text, of the life of Christ is appended to the beginning of the Psalms. And so we're reflecting exactly the same point, that you use these images meditatively, that they're to Christianize a book of Hebrew, prayers and songs, and that they provide a layer of interpretation that is in addition to or commenting on the text that's going to follow.
Okay. I wonder if you have any, are there any other examples that you would like to comment on before we finish up our time here? In particular, that's touched on? I think of the... in terms of our modern day experience, I know that there are occasionally we hear about illuminated Bibles being produced. I know in 1998, St. John's Abbey and University commissioned calligrapher Donald Jackson to produce a handwritten, hand illuminated Bible, and that's in central Minnesota. How do these continue to? So we hear about these things, and I also Bible that I love is by Barry Moser, which is illustrated with his engravings. It's called the Penny Royal Caxton Bible. How do these manuscripts resonate with us today, especially as we think about the ways in which illumination and illustration really has gone away, even to the point where we're now stripping out more and more of the apparatus around the biblical text?
Yeah. Well, it's essentially a lost art, isn't it? I mean, there are still practitioners of illumination, but I don't think any of them would say they were the true heirs, as it were, of medieval. They tried to do something different. I mean, the illumination works in very, as we've described, in various ways, part of which is to, I suppose, create an impact. It's partly to not just impact for impact itself, but it's actually to stress the text as something which is sacred, which is perhaps, it's sacred within a church setting, within church services, is the symbol of the word of Bible, or it could be in the later period that it's a symbol of wealth and status of the owner of that book. So it speaks in quite a number of ways that probably we do in different ways now. You know that, for example, I mean, there, in many Christian traditions, the Bible is still processed. The physical entity is still central within a service, but it's usually it's what it contains, or at most, what's on the outside. It could be a very opulent cover that does that, but in many traditions, of course, within Protestant or Reformed traditions, it's the words that are most important, and their meaning and significance, which means, of course, that a lot of the imagery and the sacrality of it is less relevant.
I think the one thing that's I'm reminded of as I look through the book is that you've talked about time and slowness, but with that the appreciation of silence, but the way in which the engagement with the text and the sustained effort that's represented by these manuscripts is a kind of, you know, veneration and part of making the scripture sacred, and it's a very powerful reminder of sort of what we've lost in that sense.
Yes, I mean, many of the people that undertook these books, you know, they were part of the story, if you like. They saw themselves as part of the story, and it was a core part of their religious life that they did this. I mean, towards the end, you've got people who are essentially just doing it for money, but it's still very much part of their culture. It's still very much, you know, something that they know about and know about on a daily basis.
I think also we haven't really touched on the script, and we have tried to not in the book to include examples of the text so that it's clear how the images relate to the text. And of course, one of the very rather practical and maybe more prosaic ways of thinking about it is to help you find your way around a book which doesn't have any pagination, which is all written by hand and may have quite a lot of abbreviations. And so when you have a large initial that starts a new book of the Bible or a new major section or a full-page miniature before each gospel, that helps you orient where you are. And perhaps in the modern example to which you refer, where you have a table of contents and pagination, maybe some of these finding aids are slightly less necessary.
Interesting. Yes. Well, I certainly wish we had more time to talk about these things and the individual manuscripts. Some of which are available online, is that right? Are some of these available through the British Library? Can you browse them online?
I mean, we, as Scott mentioned at the beginning, we want to make these as available as they can be, while obviously preserving them for future generations. So one of the things that we've done is presented a full digital copy that's available on our website, just simply called Digitized Manuscripts. And then you type in the individual manuscript, and this presents complete coverage, literally cover to cover coverage. I'm not sure it's every single manuscript in the book, but the large majority. And at the library, we're working to reach the goal of completing that coverage.
Oh, that's amazing. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the very exciting things is to be able to zoom in very, very close. I mean, you've said that several of these zoom in close, but you can zoom in even closer on the screen. So for those of us whose sight is slightly less good than it was, it's a fantastic way. And you see things that, you know, even if you saw it in front of you, you wouldn't see.
Yeah, it's really a great tool. And then that's accompanied by a full catalog description. So that will point readers to bibliography and describe elements of the book, like its later provenance, who owned it, all of those kind of details.
So is that an ongoing project for both of you?
Absolutely. Yes, okay. We're adding to that website literally daily.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
We've got a lot to do.
You've got a lot to do. So
we've got very vast collections, but actually one of the very striking things is that over the past 5 years, we have put an amazing amount of this sort of cover-to-cover online now in a way that, you know, was sort of unthinkable before. So there's an awful lot of these manuscripts and others like them that are available now and will continue to be, you know, increasingly available online.
Well, I certainly hope that your book, your beautiful book, and your ongoing efforts with the website will lead to a much richer and engaging, you know, appreciation of these very, very beautiful and reverent manuscripts. And so thank you for your efforts on to do that, but also for your time today to talk with me.
Right.
Thank you. Appreciate
it.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it was.
That concludes my conversation with Scott McKendrick and Kathleen Doyle about their new book, The Art of the Bible, Illuminated Manuscripts from the Medieval World, published by Thames and Hudson. Please join me again to hear about other new books in biblical studies. And to learn more about new programs as they are posted, you can follow the channel on Twitter @NewBooksBible. As always, thanks for listening.